If you're the CTO or the CEO and the company is growing, you have two choices. Either you're ready or you figure out how to be ready, or you step aside. Choice three is like you take the company down with you, right? Nobody's saying, hey, you know, here's your individual development plan and like we'll slow the growth of the company until we feel like you're maybe ready to run a company at a larger scale, right? It's like hire some people and figure it out.
Hey folks, welcome back to Executive Runtime. I'm your host, Johnny Austin. Today I'm joined by Rob Zuber, CTO of Circle CI and three-time founder who's built his career on the philosophy of being wrong as fast as humanly possible. From analyzing factory defects with an engineering physics degree to a leading distributed teams of 200 plus engineers, Rob's taken an unconventional path to the C-suite that's full of lessons for aspiring leaders. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Johnny. I'm super excited to be here.
So physics, engineering physics. So you studied engineering physics and then went to work in a production facility, making sure I got my facts straight here. Analyzing defects and optimizing factory processes. So like, how did that more hands-on manufacturing experience lead you to a career in software development?
Yeah, there's kind of two interesting parts to that. I won't say that first role was like everything I dreamed of, you know. It was, you know, you're graduating from college and you don't really know what you're supposed to do with your life. There were two things. One, we did a bunch of manual sort of data analytics, like by manual, not with calculators, but we would get data from one machine and take it to another machine and type it all into a spreadsheet. And just, it was like this whole, I thought, we're building computers here. Like, I'm pretty sure computers could do this, but I didn't know a lot. You know, in Eng Phys, I did some Fortran because people in physics in the 90s used a lot of Fortran. Like, that wasn't particularly helpful to me later in my career. I'm pretty sure I could not write one line of Fortran correctly at this point. But I was really interested in sort of the process of software, like constructing software and what problems can we solve with software, because it was directly applicable to basically automating myself out of the work that I was doing every day. So I could spend more time thinking about the interesting problems in the factory, like what is not working, because we spent the whole week basically producing that week's reports and then just did it again the next week. It was kind of ridiculous. So one thing was that, right? Like, and then some friends of mine started a company the next year, and I was like, oh, this software is really interesting. I would love to come join you. And so I ended up leaving, you know, the factory and going to work in a startup, and I've been doing that ever since. The other thing that's really interesting about it is, certainly, I don't know if this is still true today, but at least to some degree, I mean, we have all of these production metaphors, right? Like factory production metaphors in software, like Kanban. And when someone said, oh, we use Kanban, I was like, I thought that was a factory, like, because we talked about Kanban all the time in the factory, right? Like this particular factory in the year or two before I got there had switched all of their production to just in time to like a Kanban model. They had actually just built this enormous, massively expensive warehouse that they now didn't keep anything in, because stuff arrived on the shipping dock minutes before it was supposed to hit the production line, and it went out the other end and, you know, disappeared to the customer, kind of thing. So like all of that innovation that was coming from manufacturing was not actually metaphorical to me, because I was kind of there and I got to see it. And so there were some interesting takeaways, not so much in the design of software, but in the design of software delivery and how we think about, you know, just in time, how we think about pull, how we think about inventory. Like, we use all these words in software that to me are very real, because I actually spent, you know, a year, but I spent a year kind of living that life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting you bring that up, because, you know, as much of that does translate, some of it really doesn't. I remember just early in my career, you know, folks talking about Six Sigma and, you know, measuring, you know, lines of code as sort of like a key metric as to, you know, how far along a project was and things like that. And even at that early stage of my career, it didn't seem right at the time as the right thing to be measuring, but I didn't really have the mental constructs to know otherwise. So I just kind of soaked it in. But yeah, it's funny to see how things have changed since then, those early days, and how those metaphors have, some of them stuck around, some of them have kind of fallen by the wayside, but that is interesting.
Well, obviously at some point today we're gonna end up talking about AI, so I might as well just jump straight to it. I find myself using those metaphors more now.
Yeah.
As we ask questions about like what's fundamentally changing about how we build software, right? And many like feedback loops, right? So we, you know, Six Sigma, whatever, we talk a lot about process feedback. Oh, we generated a thing, is that thing good? Right. Yeah. And when it's purely designed, the way that we think about it, like humans building software, it's like that doesn't make a ton of sense. It makes a bit of sense, but it doesn't make as much sense as when we hand off to a machine constructing software and then say, okay, but it's going to do it wrong. So we need like a feedback loop that starts to correct it and move it in the right direction. So I feel myself actually reaching for those metaphors more again than the intervening, I don't want to say it, 27 years. Like that I've been doing this. So I don't know, what's old is new again.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to kind of see that come back. You're right, because when you think about the AI assisted software development process, right, it's like you said, you know, you have the machine do a thing, you have the human reviewer evaluate the results, then you refine, right? That's where the whole prompt engineering piece comes in. The machine, you know, takes another stab at it, is this good enough, and you just kind of have this flow that's going on. I guess the kids call it vibe coding. I don't know, but it just sounds like iteration to me.
Yeah.
Cool. So you're a serial entrepreneur as well. I'm curious on, you know, early on in your career, what got you into the entrepreneurial road? You know, what kind of lessons did you pick up from there before you kind of, because you've been at Circle CI for a while, but kind of prior to that, I'm curious on like, what are the hard lessons that were learned along the way that kind of fed into your success in your current role?
Yeah. My gosh. what could I summarize? So just how did I get into it real quick? I mean, it really was that transition, right? The factory work was interesting, but I found the software part more interesting. The other thing was the factory was, I don't know, 12,000, 20,000 people. Like you're running a production facility 24/7, right? So just five shifts worth of employees just on the factory floor, and then all of the engineers and all of the management and everything. And so, you know, I was constrained to a business unit. I didn't understand what the other business units even did. So that is a very different operating model. I went from there to working in a house with like eight other people or whatever the number was. And it was honestly just super fun. And I was young enough that I didn't really have a lot of concerns, right? From a like obligation perspective, et cetera. Huge credit to my mother, to be honest. Like, I was young enough to call my mom and be like, what should I do with my life? You know, I have this opportunity to go take a massive salary cut, probably work twice as much, you know, and do a thing that I don't understand. I am completely not qualified to do. And my mom was like, you will never have another time in your life where you have so little obligation, right? That this can totally fail. You will be out on the street and you'll be fine, right? Yep. Like you'll figure it out, sort of thing. Like you end up with a family, you end up with a mortgage, like all of these things that you don't understand yet, Rob, they will happen and they will make it harder to do the kind of thing that you're talking about doing. So if you're interested in doing this, go do it now, right?
Yeah.
And it ended up being really fun. It ended up being somewhat successful in the way that things were somewhat successful in 2000, meaning we had on paper a massive acquisition, but like fast forward to the future, I'm still working every day. Like it sounded awesome until it turned out the company that acquired us actually didn't have any money and sort of like everything fell apart and none of you know, paid off in the end. It looked great on paper, but I moved to California, ended up sort of like, I was living in Toronto at the time, moved to California because that's where the acquiring company was, and sort of inserted myself into the very bizarre bubble that is Silicon Valley, right? And I think there was a huge amount of that ended up paying off for me. I mean, friends of mine stayed in Toronto and have been very successful building other businesses, but there's something about this place just in terms of like things I love and hate about this place, to be honest, in terms of how focused everyone is on entrepreneurship, on technology, on trends, et cetera. I do my best to try to balance that outside of work. You know, talk to people that do other things just to remember that there's a world out there that's different. But sort of, again, inserting myself into that was super helpful in the sense that then just opportunities present themselves in ways that just don't exist in many other places, right? There's so many people starting something every day here that if you build yourself into that network, you'll find things. And so that's like one key takeaway, like get out of your house, right? I mean, we live in a world now where everyone just wants to be at their house working. I would say dot-com crash happened 2000, 2001. I was so nervous about my job that I was just trying to show up and like not be the next person to get laid off sort of thing, and wasn't building my network. And I think that cost me over time, like some opportunities maybe I missed along the way. But ultimately, like part of building your network is just doing good work with good people and maintaining those relationships, right? Like it's not all showing up at mixers and trying to like press yourself on people. It doesn't actually work that well. But just contribute to an interesting conversation, give things back, contribute, like be an effective contributor at your work, whatever. Those things, create the network such that I was then able to go, meet new people, try new things, start companies, et cetera. And I think the other, I mean, you made the comment in the intro about being wrong as quickly as possible. Like, I think all of my regrets are like, could we have been wrong sooner? Right? Could we have known sooner that this wasn't something that was going to work? Right? Like, and you have to get very comfortable, I think, in entrepreneurship with the fact that your idea is not very good. Right? It's got a glimmer of something. You might have identified an interesting problem. You might not have. And I think we idolize the very few, the Steve Jobses of the world that I don't even know who else to put in that bucket, which is like, we're going to go do this and everyone's going to love it. And the much more real part of entrepreneurship is we're going to go explore over here. And if we react quickly enough to the fact that nobody loves what we're doing and figure out what they actually need, then we might discover something really interesting, right? And certainly, I took a lot of that out of an early investment round that I did with the company that ended up getting acquired by CircleCI. That's how we got here, where the first investor, was like, I don't know, this seems fine. I don't know if you're right, but you seem like people who are going to figure something out. And I was like, they're investing in the people, not in the thing, like not in our amazing idea that we spent all of 8 minutes making a slide deck about. You know what I mean? Like that actually makes a lot of sense. Like I'm not on that. I've never been on that side of the table. I've never been like a VC or whatever. So to look at that and go, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. Like that's the bet that you're making is can these people go explore a space and find something? And will they be willing to change off of their original idea, right? Versus, is this the best idea I've ever heard? Like nobody knows, especially when it's just a, it's a drawing on a slide deck, right? So that like willingness to just be wrong and the kind of the pursuit, like the thrill of trying to find something that's right versus being super hung up on your first idea, I think is really important.
Yeah, that's a super valuable lesson. I remember that era in tech where, everyone kind of thought that they were Steve Jobs and they can impose their will onto consumers and whatnot. And so it seemed like we lost a lot in those days. But yeah, and shout out to Mama Zuber. She was right about everything.
She's very wise.
So I want to talk a little bit about Facebook, so I guess Meta these days, giant switch moment you talked about. You described Facebook's shift to mobile as a giant switch that they turned off that made businesses like yours disappear overnight. Which business are we talking about here? And then, like, how do you bounce back from market forces just that are beyond your control?
Well, get used to them because there's lots of them. So that to set the context, it's a company. The brand name was Copious. We were building a marketplace in 2011, right? And that's probably 2011 to 2013, somewhere in that range. I can't remember where in 2013. And at the time, the Facebook platform, right, designed for developers was a big thing. And so we were integrating with the Facebook platform. We had I mean, if anyone wants to know what I'm talking about, think Cambridge Analytica. Like, we were shocked at how much information we could get about other users of the Facebook platform. Like, we thought, are we supposed to be able to figure all this out? Right. And our concept was we were trying to create more connection in marketplaces, because marketplaces can be full of fraud and really, like, just, you know, difficult for people to understand, like, am I actually buying this thing, or am I just giving money to someone and the thing's not going to show up or whatever. And so we were trying to use an overlay of multiple social graphs, but Facebook was probably was like dominant at the time, to help you understand your relationship, right? So you, I mean, we know each other directly, so it's not a great example, but, like, you know, your friend lists an item on the marketplace and I see, like, oh, I have an almost direct connection to that person. Like, Johnny knows that person. I know Johnny. So I feel good. Right. And if you remember LinkedIn back then, you would see, they don't show you this anymore, you know, this person through this person who knows this person, kind of thing. Right. Like that kind of graph traversal, which is probably not what they call it to consumers, of like, how am I related? Right. And so we're using that to show your relationship, and we were just jamming stuff into the feed and the ticker. Like, Facebook was moving everything around at the time. But, like, I think that's actually the big moment. I don't know, I don't work at Spotify, but one of the things that I would identify is, at the time, Ardeo and Spotify and Pandora, to some degree, were all sort of like neck and neck in usage. And then Facebook launched the ticker and Spotify just jammed everything in there. And we were all like, oh, my friend's listening to this song on Spotify. Maybe I should switch to Spotify.
This.
Right. So, like, some people played that really well. We were taking advantage of it, and that was driving a lot of our growth and our engagement, whatever. And, like, you know, hey, your friend Johnny liked this item. Maybe you should look at that item. Like, pretty standard, you know, social network / marketplace mechanics. Anyway, yeah, so they decide, and much credit to them, it worked out, that they, being Facebook, now Meta, that they wanted to be in mobile. And that's how they were going to go figure out monetization, right? Because they were still at the point that they had growth, but they didn't really know how they were going to turn that into money.
Yeah.
And they said, this whole platform thing's not really working out for us. Maybe someone had pointed out to them that they were giving away a lot of information that people weren't super comfortable with giving away, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know that there was actually, like, a giant switch, but it's the only way I can think of it. Like they just powered down. And one morning, like, all of our growth and usage and engagement kind of vanished. So, wow, that's a lot of background context. I apologize. But then, right, we show up in the office and we're like, what do we do? Right. And so then now it's like 2013-ish. And we, you know, we had been all in on social web, like very web centric. And at that time, you've got Instagram still independent, right? Mobile photos are starting to be viable because Instagram brought filters. Like, nobody remembers how crappy cameras were back then, because now it's like better than my digital SLR, but back then it was like, I guess I could take a picture of you, but we can't even tell that it's you. So, like, filters and making things, you know, enhancing them and stuff like that was a thing that was happening. And so we tried to move the marketplace to mobile first, right? We said, okay, what would this look like? Like, that's what everyone's doing now, right? So 2013, like, I know the iPhone had been around for a while, but that was when people were really like, mobile is where we start. And so we built this marketplace app, we launched it into the App Store, and we weren't sure if it was going to stick. And App Store cycles are pretty long. Back then, it took weeks to get your app reviewed. Like, every version took weeks. And so, I mean, I build continuous integration delivery. Like, we deploy multiple times a day. The concept of spending weeks trying to get something out, like, it was really hard, right? Yeah. And so we started building multiple apps. We built some, like, I can't even remember what they were all about, but one that was sort of like, hey, I want to know. It was a little bit like Periscope, which came and went pretty quickly, but was like kind of blew up and then disappeared. I want to know what's happening somewhere else sort of situation. And so we were spinning these different ideas and we were like, the tooling, this is a very classic pivot in startups, right? The tooling to build iOS apps is terrible. Someone should solve that problem, right? And consumer apps are like, 0000 a billion, right? Like, nobody cares or it blows up. And you're just waiting for one of these things to take off and, like, turn into the next big thing. Or you're like, you're trying all these different ideas, whatever.
Yeah.
And we were like not paying ourselves, right? We had agreed with our investors to keep some of the money they had originally given us, but we said, look, we're going into totally different businesses. So we sort of like, whatever, restructured, shrunk our team, all those sorts of things. And we were back to just exploring and pivoting, exploring and pivoting. And we were like, this seems like a real problem. And there's unit economics in developer tooling. Consumer, again, if something takes off in consumer, like awesome, you're made, but many things do not take off. Whereas tooling is like you get one customer, they pay you a little bit of money. You get the next customer, they pay you a little bit of money. It's more of like, I can build a revenue stream with unit economics off of this, right? So that was, again, another pivot. We said, wait a second, this seems like a real problem. And one of the most interesting sort of data points we got was we started working on it just to try this. Sorry, this is like iOS CI/CD basically at the time, right? And every problem we ran into, we would search, and Stack Overflow, rest in peace, would come up, and there would be a question with no answers, right? And like 100 upvotes on the question and no answers. Like, and we said, no one knows how to solve these problems. Like, if we figure this out, then we will have created some real value, right? And so then we start, again, this is like going back to moving to the Bay. We're literally like roaming around San Francisco, going door to door, knocking on companies' doors. And we're like, excuse us, do you build an iOS app? People be like, yeah. We're like, how do you feel about like testing and building and getting it deployed? And they're like, oh, it's a total nightmare. We've been trying to do this, we're trying to do that. Like literally just door to door. You cannot do that in Toronto, right? Because the answer would be no on every door. Do you build an iOS app? They'd be like, what are you talking about? Right? But in San Francisco, literally, we'd go to meetups and just sort of like hustle and whatever. And we started to realize there was some real value there. But then we realized it was something bigger, which is how we ended up meeting with the folks from CircleCI and saying, oh, okay, like we'll take this piece that we figured out, integrate it into the overall platform, and so have ended up here. But yeah, like, I guess all of that to say, like, this stuff happens. Your entire market can change, and you have two choices, right? You could pretend it hasn't, and I could pretty much tell you how that's going to go. Or you can just rethink. I mean, we had like whiteboard paint in our office. It was like a little live, work, loft sort of situation. And I remember the entire like wall end to end being covered with business ideas, right? Like, what's happening in the market today? What's interesting? What are the dynamics? What can we do? Like, we're sitting here, we've got people, we've got assets, whatever. Like, what do we have? What is of value? And what's happening in the market today where we could apply those things and try to have a head start, right? We don't want to be totally tied to what we're doing, but do we have something that's of value that gives us a head start to go pursue something else? And that's like fun and terrifying, right? Like, we have no idea what we're going to do right now, but if we sit and think about it calmly, we'll come up with something. If we panic, we'll just run around in circles, and then we'll burn the rest of our cash, and we'll just go apply for jobs somewhere. So, I mean, I don't know what the real lesson is in all that, except stay calm.
Roll with the punches.
And I guess going back to the entrepreneurial lessons, like, this is what it's like. Like, you should, if you love that situation, then you'll love being an entrepreneur. If it bothers you that one day you might not have a business and you'll have to figure out something new, like, this might not be the best activity for you.
So was this the transition into to Circle CI?
Yeah, exactly. So we said, like, what we found was people were interested in what we were doing from a mobile perspective, but they wanted to be able to do it all together. Hey, like, and everyone that builds a mobile app has some kind of backend, like whether or not they even have a website, they've got something where they store the data and, you know, do they have APIs and whatever. And they say, well, how do we test this stuff? And we kept saying, we've heard CircleCI is good. You should check them out. And at some point we thought, seems like maybe these pieces would fit together, right? And we, again, CircleCI was in San Francisco. We had connections with them through, you know, friends and investors. Again, networking, right? At some point, you've met enough people. And so we just honestly dropped by, talked about what we were doing, and said, what do you think? Like, is this something that would be better together? And CircleCI was super small at the time. I think there were 14 people in the company. There was just three of us building this. We called it Distiller. So just three of us building that platform. And so we joined CircleCI. That was 2014. So we've been here. We, as myself and our now CEO, Jim, We're two of the three. Our third partner left after a couple of years at CircleCI. But we've been here coming up on 11 years at this point.
So how did that happen, the transition to being acquired to like you're the CTO and then your partner is now the CEO? Like, how did you guys sort of manage that, I guess?
Yeah, it's probably an uncommon scenario. It's not something that I would say, like, here's your playbook for getting acquired and becoming an executive. Like, sometimes it just works out, and most of the time that's not what happens, right? But the founder of CircleCI, Paul, was not as interested in building the whole organization, I would say. Like, great idea out of the gate. You know, CircleCI, to their credit, had product market fit. I feel like the afternoon that they launched, like, it was very quick. There was a real need in the market. They figured out how to address it. And like great vision from a product and engineering perspective, but was just wasn't that motivated to figure out sales and marketing and the other pieces. And so it was a very like self-aware upfront, like, hey, could you all help me out with these pieces? You know, I actually think the company might look better if we structured it like this sort of thing. It was not the intent when we joined. It was, I would say, like a few months into operating as part of the company, where he sort of came to us and said, hey, like, I feel like maybe we could take more advantage of what your skill set is. 'Cause I was just like junior developer building, you know, the iOS capabilities of CircleCI, right? I was just like, I'll just sit in my little corner over here with my headphones on and crank out some code. It's kind of nice to not be responsible for where the money's coming from for a minute. It was a nice little break. But it didn't take long to sort of say, hey, I, you know, you as in me and Jim, like, I think you guys might have skills beyond writing code. You know, could you help out? And then it was probably within 12 months of joining that we had sort of transitioned. I can't remember if, like, we took some other roles at first and then stepped into these roles. And Paul decided to step away and go start something else because that's like his passion, right? That 0 to 1, like, okay, I figured out an idea, it's working, now it's a scaling problem, right? And I think, you know, we talked a lot about Facebook. Like, Zuck is clearly someone who went from 0 to 1 and is still running at whatever size of organization. And that does happen, but it also happens that people are just like, that's not my thing, right? And I don't want it to be my thing. And some organizations will do better, right, when the people who got it off the ground find either another way to participate or decide to go do something else. And like, that's generally, if you truly love the thing you've created, then that's a reasonable way to look at it, right? What do I want? I want success for this business, as opposed to I want to be the person who's creating the success for this business, right? I did my part. I got it to this spot, and like 0 to 1 is really, really hard. Like, as someone who started a bunch of businesses and not grown them to this level, like, it's hard, right? Not every idea is going to take off. And so did an absolutely great job of getting there, but then just said, yeah, this isn't really for me. Again, not what we expected when we joined. I don't have a playbook for it, but, you know, be open to it is all I would say, is like, organizations grow and morph in different ways. And being honest about like what the best next stage or next approach is for the organization is a very mature conversation.
I think it's actually, it's more common than I think people give it credit for, you know, the, 'cause there are two different skill sets, right? 0 to 1, then 1 to many, like the whole quote unquote scale phase. Obviously you've done both. I'm curious on what you believe are the skills required to be able to kind of change modes and be able to like think about 0 to 1 growth and, you know, the scrappiness and responsiveness required there, but then also scaling to, you know, multi-hundred engineering organization to really figure out, you know, how do you get things done through these organizations? And so like they're just very different. So I'm curious on like what your perspective is in like the core skill sets that are required to do each of those really well.
I'm gonna, there's like a two-part answer. I will say enormous amounts of humility is probably the, it's, I don't, that's not really a skill, but it's critical. I'm laughing because I gave a talk at a conference last week, and I looked up my strengths finders so that I could include it as like a just but while you're listening to me, this you should know who I am because I'm going to say stuff that's not going to make sense to you. So frame it the way that I think about it. And one of my, if you're familiar with StrengthsFinders, the Clifton, whatever. So one of my top five is self-assurance, right? So like having, I need like double extra humility to be like, no, I know you think you're right, Rob, but you're probably not right. Like stop and think about it, get some feedback, whatever. Because there's, I don't think there's anyone who is equipped to do all of those things. But the only way to get equipped is to acknowledge that you're not, right? And I've been thinking about this. I think it's true that particularly for startups, if you're in any position other than the C-suite, director of engineering, right? Someone else is making decisions about when you're ready to progress, right? Oh, here's your individual development plan. When you do these things better, then I think you might be ready to consider senior director, right? And maybe we'll find, and then when there's a business need, like there's this whole very metered way. And if we need a VP of engineering and you're not ready, then we hire a VP of engineering, right? But if you're the CTO or the CEO and the company is growing, you have two choices, right? And somebody else has two choices. Like either you're ready or you figure out how to be ready or you step aside, right? Or you, well, I guess choice three is like you take the company down with you, right? Those are like the options. Nobody's saying, hey, you know, here's your individual development plan. And like, we'll slow the growth of the company until we feel like you're maybe ready to run a company at a larger scale, right? It's like, hire some people and figure it out. You know, that's your choice. And I think this is where the humility comes in, right? Is it being like, okay, I don't feel ready for that necessarily, but I have no choice but to be ready. So what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. Right. And for me, that's often, I read a lot because I'm like a book learner. It's kind of how I think. I've had the fortune at Circle CI in my tenure here that someone introduced me like 2016-ish, so pretty early in the cycle, to a local group in San Francisco, like a peer group of CTOs. They exist everywhere. You know, if you're operating at this level, you don't have generally, I mean, if you work at an enormous big five bank, there are actually 50 CTOs in the bank. In most organizations, there's one. And so you can't turn to your fellow CTO and say like, hey, what do you think we should do about this, right? Mm-hmm. And so building that network outside to say, hey, who here has been through this before? Does anyone have any ideas? And often it's comforting and discomforting because people go, yeah, that's a really hard problem. No one's really solved that. Yeah. Right. Which is like nice because you feel a little better. But at the same time, you're like, I really wish someone just had an answer that I could just take and run with. But I guess doing the work, right, to just get out and say, okay, who's looked at this problem? Who's got ideas? I'll take your ideas, but also I need to figure out what's the context of my business. My problem is unique, but it's not totally unique, right? So how can I take these things that people have done and shape them in a way that I think is going to work here and is going to be successful? Just honestly, I say this a lot to folks, like, you know, often when I'm interviewing, people ask this common question, right? Like, how come you've been here so long? Why, like, what keeps you here? And one of the things is like, yeah, I've had the same title for 10 years, but my job is different every day, right? Yeah. And so knowing that and being willing to figure out like, oh, okay, well, that's not a thing that I know, but I'm surrounded by smart people inside the company, outside the company, I have access to information everywhere, right? So let's just start by acknowledging I might not have a great answer, but I'm open to finding an answer, right? So let's do that collectively. Mm-hmm. And I think one way that I often think about it is like your job's not to have the answer. Your job is to know how to get answers, right? Mm-hmm. And when you get comfortable with that, then you're going to have a much better chance of actually getting those answers and finding ways through things.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting point because you mentioned that having ridiculously talented peers made you transition from engineering to business focus. How do you create environments that attract that caliber of talent?
Yeah, well, I would say a huge amount of, it's a great question. It's tough. A huge amount of credit to, to the founders of Circle CI and the folks that were there before me. Like there was always a focus on, I'll say like, particularly from an engineering perspective, like engineering led organization, obviously that transitions as you grow, But I guess it's like in part being a developer tools company, right? Like we were building a product and we understood the product because we were the customer of the product, and other customers of the product knew who we were, right? So like people who were really interested in great software delivery used our product and said, maybe it'd be really fun to go work on this product, right? I would not even be able to name any names, but I do recall at least one support ticket, from a customer that was like, are you all looking for people? Right? Like, I'm going to take the indirect, this is smart, right? Find another way in other than just the basic job board that was like, I love your product. I use it every day. Are you hiring? So like that kind of connection with the community, I think was really big. And it's something that we spend a lot of time thinking about is the relationship between, our hiring pipeline and our community, right? So we quite proudly often have folks follow up with us when we don't end up hiring them to say, hey, I just want to let you know it was a really great experience and it was lovely to meet everyone on the team. Like I haven't had a chance to go through an interview process like this that just felt very human because we take great care knowing that these folks are also our customers, right? Like we're going to have a relationship with them that's not just the transaction of they applied and we didn't end up finding a spot for them, right? And so I think knowing that and focusing on that is part of building an environment, from starts at the front door, obviously, like building an environment where you're bringing in folks that were engaged before they got there and are super engaged when they get there. And like I'll keep talking about humility, but I think being open, right, as a leader in technology, like I have some ideas, but y'all have some ideas. Like, let's have a real conversation and figure out what the best path forward is, such that you're engaging folks to bring what they have, right? Like, it's not necessarily that you hear this all the time that everyone, like, we have a bunch of 10x engineers. If anyone believes in that concept, we have people in an environment that allows them to excel, right? To put their ideas on the table. And then when you look around and hear them, you're like, yeah, I didn't need to come up with anything here. I could actually go focus on the other parts of the business that maybe these folks don't have the full context. And then I could spend my time taking that picture and helping them see it so they can be even more impactful.
That makes sense. You described your early leadership as pace setting and leading by example. I'm curious, how has that evolved over time? Have you adopted different flavors of leadership? Just curious on how you think about that and how you think about your personal style these days.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I probably haven't thought about that much, so this will be on the fly. I think there's always a little bit of that in me. It's like a thing that I try to, I mean, speaking of the strengths finders, right? When I look at the top five, I'm like, this is someone who is designed to not talk to humans and just like run. Get in the front of the pack and run, right? Which is not, so it's not particularly helpful. So there's a lot of, I do have to put conscious effort. Like, I think I mean, I keep talking about strengths finders because I find it interesting, right? It was super liberating to me when I was younger to say, oh, I have strengths. I have blind spots, right? Like I like the model. Therefore, I put people around me who understand those blind spots and maybe you like compensate for them. Like there's lots of sort of compensating mechanisms. And it's important to understand how you show up and the way that you lead. But that doesn't necessarily mean that like running to the front and charging ahead is always going to work, right? And so that's where I have to put the really conscious energy, I think, is like, okay, what does this situation call for? What do these people need from me, right? Like actually, these people could be at the front running. If you'd get out of the way, Rob, like what do they need to make that happen? And I'll say that's the growth. I mean, I won't sit here telling you that I'm great at it, but that's an area that I tend to put more of my thinking. Like, oh, here we go. You recognize your old habits. You're like, oh, here we go. Well, that's not gonna work, right? Like I've got whatever, we've got an organization over 300 people. And like no one person can make everything happen. Okay, so then you sit down and then I guess I will say, like, if I try to think about how to put my strengths in there, I said I'm kind of like a book learner, engineering background. So turning that into a systems problem, not to dehumanize it, but to say, okay, this is a system, right? I need this system to work effectively. How do I engineer a system? Yes, there's absolutely humans in here and I need to, but the system will work well if these people are successful. Therefore, how do I go make those people successful? And so like, I think a lot of it is just understanding how you're wired and then framing things in a way that works for how you're wired, if that makes sense, which again, doesn't mean like leading from the front all the time, because it just doesn't always work. But saying, okay, how can I make this something that I will understand and therefore will be likely to succeed at, right? Like, I think a lot of what we do as leaders is read the internet, you know, and conclude like, this is how a CTO acts and this is how they behave. And these are the skills that they bring to the table. Therefore, in order to be a good CTO, I need to go be that person, which is a massive stretch from who I am, right? Versus saying like, we are a team of executives, first of all, right? Like, I bring something to the table. These people bring something to the table. How do we maximize the contribution of this team? And how do I show up as a CTO to make my part of the organization successful? And who do I put around me, right? Like, I'm not good at this thing. So what if I put someone in place who's amazing at that thing, who loves doing it and will be super successful doing that thing? And I just say, here you go. It's all yours. You know, let's be aligned on what outcomes we're trying to get. But I'm just not good at that, right? Versus, oh, I have to be good at that or else I'm not being a CTO properly. And I don't, for whatever reason, I think part of it, I mean, you heard the backstory, like Jim and I have been working together for 14 years at this point, right? Like, we're super comfortable just being like, hey, do you want to take this thing on? It's not my thing, right? Or, hey, I see you trying to do that thing. Come on. Last 14 years, I've known you've never been good at that. So why would you do that, right? How are we going to make that work? Because our goal is to make the company successful, not to like check all the boxes that say like, I'm a good CTO.
Speaking of things that make you a good CTO and skills and whatnot. So, you know, we know each other via the conference circuit, just being like, you know, speakers at conferences. So I've always really enjoyed your talks and I think you have a really strong communication style. I'm curious if that's something that you've, you think has been advantageous throughout your career and your leadership journey, particularly when you're talking about leading large groups of people. How do you think about that?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I do think it's helpful. Again, it's like you bring your skills, right? And I think that my, if I had to think about my communication style, it's a very engineering communication style. Like my, I have a son who is in high school. So I talk, like I always joke about high school essay writing and very structured, like five paragraphs. And you have like the points that you're trying to substantiate and like your sub arguments and whatever. And to me, like when I think about engineering, that just feels very structured and mathematical. And it's like a rubric that I can follow and it's super easy. And, and in fact, my, again, my son has like, they write out like this sentence needs to be about this and this sentence needs to prove this and whatever. I'm like, how could you not get an A? Like they've literally told you exactly what you need to do. You just follow the formula, right? And so I feel like my communication is both formulaic and super improvisational at the same time. I have no idea how to put those two things together. But I think like knowing the point that I'm trying to get across and building a structure around that to make sure that I land it, like you put more effort into that, maybe in a conference talk than in a, you know, we have monthly or like R&D, our product design engineering, we get together as a group and talk about what's important. Right. Yeah. But we have enough people that it's more like a presentation. It's not a chat. And taking that, like when you've invested enough in sort of like those structures and that becomes habit, then you think about it as you communicate to folks. Right. And I've also done a decent amount of written communication to folks in the organization. Same thing. Right. Like I'll start often, anyone listening to this will probably realize this, just like stream of consciousness. And then I look at it and go, no one knows what point I'm trying to make. I also have, speaking of humility, people that I work with who will look at something I've written and go, Rob, this is not your best work. Like nobody knows what you're trying to say in this. I'm like, all right, cool. Let's talk about it. Like, okay, what point are we trying to make? What do we want people to leave the room with or like read this and leave with? What's the key takeaway?
clear out. Maybe there's too many anecdotes and side stories and whatever, which all seem fun to me at the time, but none of them are getting the point across because it gets lost in there. Let's break it down, simplify it, you know, and I think communication is the job, but everyone talks about like, we need to improve communication. Like if you don't hear that all day, every day in your company, then like, please tell me about it. But
yeah,
some people mean like, I need my Jira tickets to be better written. Some people mean like, we need to better understand the goals of the organization and the intent. Like, why are we doing those things? Right.
Yeah.
And I think intent is one of the biggest challenges in many organizations, and sort of being comfortable backing up, talking through that, finding a way to structure it that people understand it. No disservice to anyone else. I am an engineer, so I can only say it fits my engineering brain, this like structured model of communication.
Yeah.
I know many great communicators who are not engineers, just to be clear. In fact, probably more of the great communicators I know. But also structuring it in with like an engineering framing, given that the majority of people I'm trying to communicate to are also engineers, I think helps it land better. Right. Yeah. Although, I will say, I think you were actually at this particular talk, but someone came up to me at a conference last week and they said, I saw you speak 2 years ago and you told this story about shoveling snow off the roof of your house.
I was there.
And I was like, I think they were like quoting the story. Right. And I was like, let's not forget stories. Right. Because I'm telling this whole thing, like build a framework, put it in the structured framework, whatever. But ultimately, it's stories are really the cornerstone of human connection. That's what we remember. And so I think the combination of those two things is ultimately when I need people to understand something, it's much more, it connects much better when I can tell them about this customer is doing this thing and they're having this problem. And we have that, like, I know that you suffered with that last week. So let's talk about why we're going to go try to solve this problem, right? Versus just, hey, let's build this thing. Right. And so I do think like story is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% agree. So we are getting close on time, but I wanted to ask you a bit about family. You know, being an entrepreneur is hard. It takes a lot of your time, but then also leading an organization of several hundred people is hard. It takes a lot of your time. So how do you maintain those boundaries and presence with, you know, priorities with your work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, like everything else, I'll tell you what I think about, which does not mean I'm an expert, right?
Yeah.
I think it's probably my view has probably shifted over time. You know, the 0 to 1 days, the like I'm responsible for huge parts of this days. A lot of that was setting expectations up front and just having honest, like, hey, I'm going to go do this thing. Right. So in this case, I'm talking about with my wife, I'm contemplating starting this company, whatever, this is what it's going to be like for the next couple of years. Like, are we okay with that? Right. Yeah. Cause that's a decision we have to make together. Like, I can't just show up and be like, hey, by the way, I quit my job and start this company with these people I just met. Sure. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Don't have a paycheck. And so that, you know, that's kind of the entrepreneurial side. And I would say like a huge amount of that, like the support that I get from my family, like my wife works at a much more stable and has always worked at a much more stable, like Circle CI is pretty stable right now, but like in those early days, you know, made it possible, both through just like personal support, but also just the way that we think about structuring, you know, our ability to do any of these things. Right. Kind of like a portfolio. If you think about portfolio, like you get kind of a portfolio of two when it comes to jobs in your family, depending on how you work, and the structure of your family, like both in my family, let's just say that. And so being, you know, setting expectations, being really clear about that, and honestly being really thankful for it, thankful enough probably most of the time. And then now I think, I guess the thing that's evolved is the realization, I think a lot of us saw this from 2020 to now, just how much our personal lives and work lives are connected, right? Like we used to believe, you know, that we were in severance, you know, like we go to the office and that's like one life, and then we go home and that's a different life, and then all of a sudden we're in each other's houses over Zoom and whatever. And we started to connect with that more, and I think realizing that a huge part of showing up well as a leader at work is having your own crap in order, right? In some form.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's always in order, but like, but if that, like, it, and it goes the other way too, right? Like being super stressed out about work flows over in your family and you don't show up well in your family, right? And unfortunately, it probably typically goes that way more than the other way.
Yep.
And so, you know, when you start to view the things that you do for yourself and for your family as the things that make you a better person, put you in a better frame of mind, like all of those things, so that when you show up at work, you're much more effective, then it becomes less of a, like, I'm sacrificing work to go do this other thing, which is not a place that is healthy to be in your head, but certainly entrepreneurs get there a lot, and more like, I am putting myself back in a state where I'm going to show up and be really effective,
yeah, you
know, at work. And so that was a, if I'm honest, probably a process for me to go through and a transition that I had to make for myself to be like, oh, this is actually not being selfish, you know, to go spend some time with my family and do things with my family, whatever. It's like me becoming a better person overall, which means when I show up at work, I'm in a better frame and I can, you know, just bring more out of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it, Rob. I really appreciate it, my friend. You've been super generous with your time today. And thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you, John. It's been super fun.
If you enjoyed today's guest and you'd like to help support the show, please subscribe, leave a rating, and share this episode. As always, thank you to our listeners, and be sure to tune in to the next episode of Executive Runtime.